CIA, motherfucker.
Wise man say, forgiveness is divine, but never pay full price for late pizza.
Cause you're a freak with a microphone.
Uh-huh.
I am an FBI agent.
You're listening to the Super Podcast, featuring hosts Super Marcy.
And I think everybody these days can relate to Serial Mom.
And Pete the Terrible Aussie.
Well, one of my pet peeves in movies, like people sitting down to have dinner and they don't actually finish the dinner.
This podcast contains coarse language.
Pete, watching this, like, I just want to go and...
Adult themes.
Like, this whole movie is just hinges on someone's ass.
And potential spoilers.
Spoiler alert.
Listener discretion is advised. Visit supermarcy.com for more information. Now for our feature presentation.
Listen, sister, if I want your opinion, I'll beat it out of you.
By the way, his testicle retrieval operation went quite well.
White Russian. No ice. Hold the vodka. Hold the Kahlua.
Isn't this 4215 pussy way?
G'day everyone, this is B. Jemine, aka The Terrible Aussie, and welcome back to episode 165 of the Super Podcast, the flagship show of the Super Network. And with me as always is my lovely co-host, the one who created this show way back in the day, and that of course is the one, the only, Super Marcy. Hello Marcy, how are you?
Hey, hey. Yeah, way to remind me that I started this show like... how many years ago now? I mean, next year, I think it's the 13th anniversary of the Super Podcast.
Well, this next year, it's going to be the 14th anniversary.
Well, maybe the 14th. Yeah. Mm. I mean, it was 2009. Like, I can't believe I've been doing this for that long. It's weird.
Yeah, I know. And also, like, I mean, I joined up the same time as you did, because you did the show for a while. Then I came on as a guest and then came back and more over time, then eventually... just been promoted to co-host. Yeah, no. It's kind of weird that we're still doing this show 14 years later, and we're probably one of the only few shows, like podcasts, that came out in 2009 and are still running today.
Well, probably still with the same true, like, well, from me originally, then with you coming on board, and we are still co-hosting because, you know, we became best buddies.
Exactly. But, you know, we've expanded the Super Network. We have a billion shows that all of our listeners are aware
of. We do.
And we both have our own solo shows as well that are outside the network. So
it's an addiction.
It is. It's a podcast addiction. But it's been a lot of fun. So it'll be interesting to see where the journey goes from here. But it's great to be back. Like, yes. We did a commentary on the previous episode, but doing a topic episode, which we haven't done in a little while.
Very excited. We also have a very special first-time guest joining us.
Indeed. We have a very special guest who's joining us for the very first time. So he's getting a cherry popping, as we like to say, on this podcast. he is a novelist and also a filmmaker. And that, of course, is Aaron Dries. Hello, Aaron. How are you? And welcome to the Super Podcast.
Thank you so very much for having me. Can I confirm, is that 14 human years?
Yes.
That's a long time.
And I'm still 21.
Considering I'm getting my cherry pop tonight, I'm glad everyone is over the age of 18.
Indeed. Because to be fair, when I started...
Feel free to edit that out, by the way.
No, this is all going to be kept in. We always keep the stuff in on the show because it's hilarious. Also, when I started co-hosting this show, I was a fetus at the time, which makes it even more amazing.
Mm.
So
a lot of squishing sounds, a lot of squishing.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah,
like the suckling. Have you ever seen the suckling?
I have seen the suckling.
I haven't, but Bede keeps telling me not to.
Look, it's, let's put it this way, it's no Schindler's List, but it's still pretty good.
I'm totally gonna watch it. It's free on Tubi. Let's go.
Exactly.
Yep.
Which we may have to do for, of course, our other podcast, the Tubi Tuesdays podcast.
We're just here self-promoting, like, on our own podcast. What a bunch of whores we are, Bede. Yeah.
Exactly. But so we're very happy that you're joining us tonight, Aaron, because it's very exciting to always have a new guest on this show. So tell our audience all about you, because not only, because like I said, you're an author and a filmmaker. So what have you got out at the moment you would love to talk to us about? Because I know you got quite a lot of books, because I was on your website earlier, because I knew you've had a few books, but I didn't realize you had so many books out over the years. So what are some of the most recent ones that you have out at the moment you'd like to talk to us about?
Yeah, sure. Look, my most recent release, and I have been writing for a while now. It's over 10 years. I don't know where that time went. My website definitely needs a bit of an update. I've aged. The writing industry has stripped me of my youth. But I've been, doing this for a while now, which has actually been really, really great. And my most recent release was a collection of short stories called Cut to Care, a collection of little hurts, which came out this year. It's got an introduction by Mick Garris, who was very kind in doing me a massive solid by writing that introduction for me. That's a collection of really messed up, disturbing horror stories, all based around the theme of caring, which kind of boiled to the surface during lockdown. I'm a frontline mental health worker and working within the youth and women and children surviving TV, mental health intervention, homelessness space. And so I had to get all of these toxins out of my head somehow. Oh, and so I wrote it all down. And then the book is like therapy on the page. I love that book. I think it's the most me of all the things I've probably written. So it's a collection of short stories all based around that theme, ranging from like psychological thrillers to like really like, there was one where one of the stories was like, I really just want like a really, really gay, like trashy 90s single white female style, like, you know, dirty, trashy, like horror thriller story. So I finally wrote one of those, which is really good. There's a Western around this theme, like, you know, said at the turn of the century, Australia, all the way through to what a nursing home looks like in the future. And it's massively fucked up. So there's stuff in there for everyone. The lead story is called Damage Incorporated, and it's about social workers who are sent into the homes of people who are grieving after losing loved ones, and these social workers act out in wigs and costumes the people who have passed away to help the families grieve. And it's about the one worker who does the job too well and the family won't let her leave. And so it kind of turns into a bit of a misery style kind of claustrophobia piece. And that was recently adapted into a short film that I was a part of. And look, we made this short film during COVID, and the director Joshua Koski is just insanely talented and made something really, really special. And this thing is just gone big, and it's won more awards than you can fit on a poster. And it's super, super great. And it's opened doors and pathways to us being able to look at a lot of other stuff, some of which is happening and I'm not allowed to talk about.
That's
and
fair.
Some of which is but fantasy. Yeah, you know, they call it, it's Hollywood close, you know, so it means like, you know, it's close, but it could all fall apart at any second. So it's best not
Fingers
to jinx
crossed.
It too much, but there's some really great, yeah, there's some really, really exciting stuff happening there. And then my release prior to that was a little novella that I put out called Dirty Heads, which is a kind of a cosmic coming of age story set in Australia. Pretty autobiographical. It's about a young kid who's coming to terms with his sexuality, but who is obsessed with going to the video store. And essentially he sees his life replicated in the VHS covers, and then the VHS covers start coming to life. And it's just huge, big cosmic kind of, you know, monster mash. And it's super duper sad. And then before that, I wrote a couple of novels, House of Size, which has been recently optioned for film, The Forlorn Boys and A Place for Sinners. And I co-wrote a zombie novel with a guy named Mark Allen Gunnels called Where the Dead Go to Die. So I've been doing all that. I've been doing more filmy related stuff, a lot of writing on that front. And I do visual arts on the side as well, illustrations, drawing, things like that. So look, anything that keeps me occupied here in sunny Canberra, I'm happy to jump on board. And when I'm not doing all those things, there's my day job. And when there's not that, then I'm hanging out with nice people like you guys.
Well, clearly you're a man after my own heart. So we have to be new BFF. Sorry, B.
Oh, well, I was going to say, because like Aaron, you wrote one of your stories is something that's definitely right up Marcy's alley, because Marcy does love a good stalkerous story. So
I do. I love stalker obsession things, and that's probably really demented because I've suffered as a victim of these things. It's almost like a weirdly therapeutic thing, But yes, my like for all us nerds who use Letterboxd, my top four movies are all like stalker obsession movies at the moment.
I totally get what you mean. I had, look, as far as it ever went was somebody who didn't like the word no, and then would appear through some other kind of, you know, way of getting in contact with you. And then just when you think that this, you've kind of knocked all these things on the head, there's another way for them to contact you. And that actually gave me tremendous anxiety, and I hated it so much. And that particular story, that kind of gay, trashy 90s throwback thriller, domestic thriller that I've been wanting to write for ages, that's in this collection, and it's called The Acknowledged, it stems from all those anxieties. And it's about a guy who's didn't go home for Christmas to see his family because he's just gone through this awful breakup, and he's basically locked himself in a hotel room, eaten grossly and drunk wine for 3 days in the air conditioning. And then he comes out of this thing, it's like goes for a big run through a national park and finds a young man who has fallen down a cliff and broken his legs. He saves his kid, and this kid doesn't know any sort of sense of boundaries, and is determined to make sure that our hero knows how grateful he is. That starts off in little ways, thank yous, and then the thank you that comes at the wrong time of the night, food that's delivered, visits in the night. And it's just this gradual escalation, and that type of stuff scares the shit out of me, because people who don't know the value of the word no are very, very frightening people.
You're not wrong there at all.
Yeah. Scary stuff. So it's basically that a cut to care. I'm really, really proud of it. It's all my anxieties down the page, and probably when it was all finished and I looked at it all, and I was like, wow, I really need to kind of check myself before I wreck myself, because if this is what is actually going on in my head, I need to make some changes in my life, and I actually did. So that therapeutic in concept and execution, so to speak. And it's opened up some doors for me. Some exciting stuff on the horizon. And then, you know, there's just the writing always ticking away in the background. And I do it for love, and I do it because it's my thing. I've been doing it since I was a kid, and I've been managing to do it professionally on the side for about 10 years now. And where the hell did that, in human years?
Right. Where did that go?
No idea. Where did it go? Yeah, so that's me.
And that's you. Well, it sounds like, I mean, for some of us, dealing with lots of lockdown and just trying to avoid COVID, which sadly has got one of us here as we record. I'm sorry, Bede.
Yep,
I'm sorry, Bede. I think for some of us, it sort of opened up a lot more creativity and just time to actually do things. And I know that the two of us were really... like, we were really busy keeping ourselves busy in lockdown with lots of projects and creative things. And I think that's almost like changed my mindset on things. Like, I'm more determined to want to do things. I just need the energy to do it. I'm glad you had that, because it sounds like it's a book I need to read like right now.
Well, look, lockdown was an interesting thing, because I wish I'd been locked in to some degree. Like, and I know that's such a facetious thing to say, but I worked all the way through it. And during lockdown, domestic violence rates went through the roof.
Yeah.
The emergency call outs, the amount of people who became homeless, especially women and children. So I've never been busier, and I absolutely needed to make sure that I was looking after myself. And the whole idea of cut to care emerged from that. And I'm now at a point where I'm like, I wouldn't mind a little rest, just a little rest, just a
refresher,
just the tip of rest.
Yeah, so, I can imagine it's very difficult with the kind of job you have. And how do you not take that home with you? But I guess that form of therapy for you is kind of getting that all down on the page.
Yeah, totally. It probably explains why my stuff is so messed up, you know. And that's the whole thing about horror movies. People are like, why would you see and do? And we all know this. We've heard these conversations. People say this to us all the time. Why considering everything that's going on? Why would you go home and watch The Suckling? Or why are you going to go home? Well, you don't have to watch The Suckling. It is out there on Tubi. I don't want to feel like we're making this. The Suckling is not the theme of today's, you know, featured show, but it just keeps coming up, just like it comes out at Sewer. I mean, you watch something really, really scary, and I'm like, well, I want to give myself permission to feel something that I'm feeling already, but I'm allowed to do it for an hour and a half. You know, what did I watch the other day? I watched Ordinary People, like from 1981. I'd never seen it before. And I sat there on the couch and cried and cried and cried. And I was like, and then the movie finished and I got up and I wiped my eyes. And I was like, oh, I feel great. It's, you know, we've got this spectrum of emotion and I'm really, really glad that I allow myself when I'm watching movies to acknowledge that I actually do have emotions that are beyond just feeling, yeah, I'm chill as fuck. No, I'm not. I'm riddled with anxiety. I'm scared of things. And often things make me sad, but I'm not allowed to feel that or show it in between the hours of like sun up and sun down. So movies are kind of like that chill place. It's kind of a nice messy boxing ring with yourself, really. And that's why I love scary stuff.
Oh yeah. Like it's, I think I, like, during the many lockdowns we had here in Melbourne, like,
between, the never-ending lockdown.
Yes. Like, between, like, all the podcasting we did and a couple little creative projects we did and all that, I was watching a lot of movies and especially a lot of horror films. But I think, again, like, horror films do give that sort of cathartic feeling when you're watching it, especially ones they kind of dealt with. Like some similar things that were happening in our world. Because it's kind of like when people, I kept hearing like a lot of people were watching the Steven Soderbergh film Contagion during lockdown. Like,
and they still didn't wear a bloody mask.
Indeed.
Yeah.
And it was just funny to me. It's like, why are you people watching this movie? Like that movie is terrifying. But then I realized like I can, like, A, that movie is kind of almost is accurate to what actually was happening in the world at the time. Except for, you know, the toilet paper all disappearing.
no one could have predicted the great toilet paper shortage.
Exactly. And
no one.
But also, I guess it was like one of those things, like people found it kind of cathartic to watch a movie like that or something like a film with zombies that deals with viral outbreaks or diseases and stuff like that. It's like, but kind of seeing it in a more fantastical setting definitely, again, gives that kind of more cathartic kind of feeling that you have that you're like you're seeing a more fantastical version of this kind of scenario rather than seeing the real life version.
Yeah, and it was funny because like during those lockdowns and I was trying to do 31 Days of Horror and such, like some films popped up that were made like a few years ago, but it's like this just really accurately represents this like isolation and all these weird things we're going through, even though it's not about a virus outbreak or something. And it just kind of moved me in an interesting way. And one of those was, what's it called? The Night Eats the World, I think, was the one. Yeah. And just, bowled me over. But it was like definitely something that I really needed to watch because it just, it weirdly put things into perspective in a way that, things could probably be much worse.
Yeah, exactly.
100%. Yeah. I definitely watched both versions of The Stand during lockdown. I remember.
We did too. We did too, because we did that for an episode of one of our other podcasts, The King Zone, which we had to discuss. We discussed both the original and new TV miniseries versions of The Stand. So watching both of those was kind of a very unsettling feeling, watching both of those at the same, within the span of a few days.
I'm like, how the hell, you know, like Stephen King and Mick Garris, it's like, how the hell do you like do this, like, however many years ago, and it's like, but you just know that these types of people are going to be like this during something like this, and we're seeing it. It's just, it's so I won't talk about the newer one.
No, we're not gonna mention it. There are moments in the new one that appeal to me. I might be in the minority, but I really like the guy who played, what's his name?
Don't say Harold. Say Harold.
I was totally going to say Harold.
Don't say Harold.
I loved his kind of manic Tom Cruise insanity, but look, that was pretty much it. I love the original miniseries. Like, you know, there's a reason I asked Mick to do the introduction to my book. Like, that was an incredibly powerful thing to me. And amazing. When I saw it, I remember it airing. I was really young. I was far too young to be watching it. And it was a family event. They're like, right? Oh, my kids, we're all sitting around and we're going to watch The Stand. I'm like, what's A Stand, Mom? Basically, that was my gateway to Stephen King, which absolutely changed my life. And I'll never forget watching that opening sequence with Don't Fear the Reaper. It's just...
It's amazing.
The other bit in... from when I was a child, the other bit that gave me terrible, terrible nightmares is a sequence that I don't think people talk about from the miniseries very often, but it's the seduction of Harold by Nadine. And, you know, it's this super sexualized kind of close-up on eyes and on lips and drinking wine, and then there's blood on the walls and there's the color red everywhere. It absolutely scared the crap out of me when I was a kid. That and the Lincoln Tunnel sequence. But look... We'll save that for another podcast.
Well, since we are talking about Stephen King, I think that'd be a good segue to our topic for this episode, which, of course, is the top three books that changed our lives. Now, I know, talking to both of you, we had a bit of a struggle trying to narrow down our list.
I've actually changed mine again. But I think I'm actually set on my three, so let's go.
Yeah, I think we can get started. And Marcy, why don't you start things off by telling us what is your number three book that has changed your life?
Yeah, look, there's so many, and there's ones I can't even honestly remember, you know, from the ages of like 10 onwards. I used to read like 3 to 4 novels a week. And watch a fuckload of movies because I was the outcast kid who was quiet and kept to myself and did all these things. So, yeah, the fact that I can barely remember anything now is a bit sad. But, yeah, I actually thought long and hard about, like, at least my third pick because there was a few options. One of my options I am going to discuss at length on a future episode of After Dark with Super Marcy, an adults-only podcast, self-promotion. But yeah, actually just thinking about more things that I've read in the last maybe 10 years that I think have actually really changed me in ways I probably didn't expect is Cheryl Strayed's novel Wild, which was just about her own experiences. If you are unaware with the book or the film adaptation that I don't know anybody that had anything to do with that movie, wink, wink. But yeah, like in anticipation for the film, I was being told like, yeah, like you'd need to read the book. I'm like, oh, yeah, okay. It was something I couldn't put down. It's just, it's a very raw book. Like Cheryl doesn't hold back about her demons, her problems, you know, addictions, where, you know, she was at a point where her life was basically in the toilet and she just makes this decision, I'm going to go hike this massive trail. And she has no experience. She brings way too much stuff and she kind of learns all these things of survival and getting through it along the way. But it's all these things like her thoughts as to sort of looking back on her past and where she is now and all these changes. And by that end, you know, she kind of describes like parts of her life after and how much has changed. And just reading that kind of opened my eyes to some of my own problems and me not actually dealing with them and just having this long-term goal to kind of get to somewhere where I'm actually happy and satisfied. And I think I am well on my way to getting there. But just that change that reading that book had in me with actually thinking about things I just wouldn't have realized. And I think just how open and emotional that book is, it was almost a reminder for me that there's no reason for me to hold back and be like, I'm okay when I'm not okay. Like, fuck that shit. I don't know if either of you have read it. I mean, the film is mostly fairly accurate. Like, obviously can't adapt everything from a book, but it gives you the gist of it.
Well, I haven't read the book myself, but I had seen the movie because you and I saw it at an early screening for it.
We went to special screening at Moonlight Cinema, which was an incredible experience to watch a film like that out in the open in the Botanical Gardens.
Indeed, indeed. But Aaron, have you read the book? What?
I haven't, but I know of it. And the reason I know of it is that this is kind of a labyrinthian path to get to Wild. But the reason I know of it is that I fell into, I don't know about you both, but I fall into Warren holes of like, of interest where I'm like not willing to let things go until I explore an entire kind of subgenre or a particular director. 100%. You're my people. I totally know you get it, right?
Yeah.
Well, I was massively looking forward to an album that came out this year called Queens of the Summer Hotel, which was by Amy Mann, and it's an adaptation of Girl Interrupted by Susanna Kaysen, the original memoir. Mm. And and I thought, well, before this concept album comes out, I want to read the original book I'd seen in the movie years and years ago. And I read it and was absolutely confronted with how raw and real this particular book was. It's about essentially like a very young woman who is institutionalized for years in a hotel because she's, frankly, she's female in like 1964 or whenever it's set, and has opinions, and so she's institutionalized and misdiagnosed by a man within a 15-minute consultation, and is put in a essentially a ward for the next few years. That particular book really, really rattled me, and I was like, "What else is out here like that?" And that led me to Prozac Nation, which I thought was really, really impressive as well. From that, I read The Bell Jar. And then on this, like, you know, this little labyrinthian path, there was Wild. And I was like, I'd need to read this. And the link there is that kind of confrontational, it's okay to say I'm not okay vibe. Mm. And I need to read this book.
Mm. I think also just the fact that, you know, her life is in the fucking shitter and she's like, you know what, I'm going to do something. I'm going to do this crazy fucking thing. And like looking at that, and I just realized like I probably just can't let anxieties and stuff win, that I need to go do things that are specifically for me and not being afraid. But yeah, I would say that book has honestly had a real profound impact on my life. And the fact that it took me to today to actually think of it, because I was rattling my brain looking at my shelves and I'm like, oh my God. Like, this book has legit changed my life. My brain just don't work. But yes, that would be number three for me. And yeah, I think I'm very proud to say that that was one of my picks. So awesome. Cheryl Strayed will never listen to this, but if she does, thank you.
And Aaron, what is your number three book that has changed your life?
Oh my God, I'm having total, like, you know, existential crisis because I'm like, what if I've chosen wrong?
There are no wrong answers.
There are no wrong answers. Let me preface this by saying I've got four stacks around me. I actually couldn't not bring these books into the room so I can visualize them in case I want to change things up as we go along, which I might. And I can't begin a conversation about books that have changed my life without talking about Stephen King, who is not on this list, because I can't pinpoint a book. I can only pinpoint the man. And I know if I was going to pinpoint a book, it'd probably be Dance Macabre. Like, that book opened the door to me to a world of literature that I never knew was out there. But, and I know this is probably like a really strange thing to say, but when it comes to Stephen King, I don't think outside of my parents and my grandparents, any single person in my life has shaped me more as a human being than Stephen King. Because there is a lot of my moral compass that was set from absorbing all that stuff when I was really young. Mm-hmm. There is the world that had opened up to me. There is the my curiosity often came from Stephen King, and my passion for reading came from Stephen King. But that's impossible for me to pick up. So I ran away screaming because I couldn't choose. So
look, I'll say this. Look, I could have just picked Stephen King for this, but I've saved as a slight spoiler for the rest of the podcast. My number one is a Stephen King book.
I was so hoping it would be, because I felt as though we could cover off all our bases. But now I'm still having this existential drama. Which one of these three do I want to say? Which one of these three? Okay, I'm going to say that my number three book is Rebecca by Daphne du Maurier. Have either of you read Rebecca?
I actually haven't, but it's something I've been curious to read. Mm. And I actually think we had a discussion about it, that we, you know, as a potential topic of conversation would be like the book and the films about with Rebecca. Mm. So, but please, I need totally. To shut up.
No. So Rebecca was written by Daphne du Maurier in, I think it must be like 1938, 1939. And it is a gothic thriller romance with the veneer maybe of a ghost story, but there's no ghost. And it's about this very young woman, unnamed, who is essentially falls into a relationship with a very, very wealthy aristocratic man who takes her back to Cornwall, to his mansion, which is called Mandalay, where she realizes that his ex died and she is kind of the second Mrs. De Winter. She is the follow-up to the wife. And so she's continuously being compared by the servants, by the cousins, by all these other family members. And there is this dominating, monstrous housekeeper, like this matronly figure named Mrs. Danvers, who was most likely in love with Rebecca and is absolutely filled with fury that this strange young, almost character deficient, as she would say it, child has come into their home to replace Rebecca. Mm-hmm. And it is claustrophobic. It is gaslighting to the nth degree. It is anxiety riddled. And it's about a woman having to find agency and a voice. And it's about sexuality. And there are all these queer underlying kind of subtext riddled through it. Daphne du Maurier was bisexual, had relationships with men and women throughout her life. Then often spoke about the boy in the box, who was the sense of maleness inside her that she couldn't think of a way to articulate until she was very, very late in her late years, but incorporated these themes of sexual kind of amorphous kind of, you know, relationships throughout all of her works. And it's probably never more prominent or as sexy or scary and spooky gothic as it is in Rebecca, made into one of my favorite films, which is Rebecca from 1940 by Alfred Hitchcock with Joan Fontaine and Laurence Olivier. And it is just this amazing film. I love it to bits. It's one of those films that if I'm home alone, what am I going to do today? I'm going to chuck on Rebecca and sit here. My own neighbors must think I'm mad, you know, because it begins this with this wonderful voiceover that's taken straight from the book, which is "Last night I dreamt I went to Mandalay again," and I play it really loud. And I listen to the audiobook often as well. But du Maurier writes richly and she writes evocatively. And she was the first author who ever kind of said to me, I'm going to write about myself, but I'm going to do it through my fiction. And I'm going to see if I can heal something that maybe is unresolved in me through a creative process. And I remember reading it. It was the first adult piece of fiction that I read outside of Stephen King when I was young. And I picked it up from my school library. And I remember my English teacher, when she saw me reading it, she's like, I didn't like that book. And I remember defiantly reading it to defy her. And when I loved it, I was able to articulate why in this massive presentation. It was like this, it was almost like a revenge.
that I relate I to this. Idea.
Does that make sense? Like, you know, you get kind of defensive. And also, I'm a kid, like, I was late to reading. Like, you know, my parents were like, come on, man. Look, and my dad was a huge reader. My grandfather was a big reader. And they're like, look, you're not a sporty kid. We need to get you invested in something here. And somebody gave me an R.L. Stein book. It was like Stay Out of the Basement. And I was like, oh, reading is fun. And I made the jump from R.L. Stein straight to Stephen King. And that's
relatable.
But it was Rebecca. Rebecca was the one. Rebecca made me go, there is more to stuff in the text, and it resonated with me probably because I was a young queer kid at that time and didn't even realize it. So it massively changed the way I think, and I keep coming back to it, and it's a different book every time I read it. I've read it about 5 or 6 times. I love this book. It's absolutely gorgeous and suspenseful as if only we I could write something as suspenseful and as beautiful as Daphne du Maurier did when she wrote Rebecca. And she's amazing. She wrote The Birds. She
right?
wrote Don't Look Now. She wrote Jamaica Inn. Daphne du Maurier, we need to, like, you know, credit her with, like, her influence right? on psychological thrillers. I don't think that there's Gone Girl or the, you know, a lot of these kind of, you know, pot boilers that comes, because she was dismissed at the time as being like a female popular writer. You know, and were one of those rare cases where women were writing under their own names and not under an acronym that could be construed as being male. And, you know, with the birds, like the influence that we don't credit her with on eco horror disaster fiction, to, you know, like to the Towering Inferno, to The Day After Tomorrow, you know, these huge, big ecological disaster, you know, pieces. I think a lot of that stems back to the birds. And so she's just, Daphne du Maurier is the bomb. She's great. And I and the reason that I picked up that book and went to the library and saw it back then is because it was intense macabre in the appendices at the back of Stephen King's nonfiction piece. And I was like, oh, I have to read that because he spoke about it so evocatively. So that's my choice number three. And now that I've said it out loud, I feel like I made the right choice. Thanks for this therapy session. It's been good for me.
Well, thank you very much for sharing that, because like I've seen both film adaptations of Rebecca. I haven't actually read the book itself, but I've always been curious to kind of go back, like to actually read it myself. So like hearing you talk about it is definitely made me even more curious to read it.
Look, so both the 1940 film and the one from a couple of years ago, they're both really, really faithful adaptations of the book. But of course, you definitely got to give the book a go because there's something so special about it. And also the way she writes is so lyrical and rich. It's a red wine. You know what I mean? It's not a chilled Chardonnay. This is a big, bold Shiraz of a book. And it's super decadent and great and weird and kooky and crazy and kinky and fun. Check it out.
Yeah, I'll definitely have to. For sure. All right. Well, we'll go to my third book that has changed my life. This is a book that when I first, like, here's the interesting thing about my book.
It's not the like, Bible, is it? Because we ain't talking that shit.
Well, that's an honorable mention, but that's beside the point. But anyways, what this book is, like, pretty much all the books I picked for my top three have been made into movies, but my pick for number three is a book that's about a movie, the making of one. So my number three book is The Disaster Artist, My Life Inside the Room, the greatest bad movie ever made by Greg Sestero and Tom Bissell. which, of course, is, as the title suggests, is about actor Greg Sestero writing about his time working on The Room, aka the Citizen Kane of bad movies, and also working with the one and only Tommy Wiseau. Like, one of the things, like, Marcy and I are huge fans of The Room. I saw it first and then I introduced her to it later on. And so we became obsessed with it. So when I heard that this book was coming out and Greg Sestero, who himself wrote it, or co-wrote it, I should say, I just immediately knew I had to get it. Like, I bought the book. It was on my shelf for a little while, but then once I went away to go visit my brother up in Darwin for Easter, I thought, you know what? It's about time I finally give this book a read. So I did, and I read it over the course of 4 days. Like, I just could not put it down. Like, I thought I knew all the stuff that happened
right?
and the scenes of this movie, but it was nothing compared to the actual insanity that happened behind the making of the film. But what I think is really great about the book is that not only is it go into the madness that was making The Room, like everything that went wrong with that film did, the fact that, like, just for the, I did not kill her, it's bullshit, I did not hit her, I did not, scene, they did that, like, at least nearly 100 takes, because Tommy Wiseau kept stuffing up the line over and over again. And the only way he finally did it is that they just gave him a bottle of water in his hand and he just threw it on the ground. So that was how he was able to remember the line. But what I think is amazing about the book is it really is about the friendship between Tommy Wiseau and Greg Sestero. The origins of it, of where Greg Sestero was in an acting class. And that's where Tommy Wiseau, in one of the greatest things I've ever read in a book, is him doing an entire monologue of the stellar moment from A Streetcar Named Desire. But we know that, you know, there's a big monologue and all that there. But the thing is, though, he only just keeps shouting out, Stella! Over and over again, and literally ripping up the stage, climbing up on curtains, and the entire audience, like the everyone else in the acting class, is just bursting out laughing. However, Greg Sestero was transfixed by Tommy Wiseau and was like, I need to work with this guy. And then, of course, a friendship blossoms. And then as they're kind of both struggling actors trying to make a break, that's when Tommy Wiseau decides, you know what? I'm just going to go make a movie. So he mysteriously got $6 to $7 million somewhere, decided to go make this movie. And yeah, and it just kind of charts like how that film just was made, but also kind of the struggles that even afflicted their friendship through it. And it is a both absolutely hilarious book. Like, I know Tommy Wiseau has said, like, oh, yeah, a lot of the things that are in the book are exaggerated, but I personally think, like, Greg Sestero was 100% correct about everything that he says happened in that book. But it's just also a really entertaining read. It's very funny. It's also quite moving as well, especially during one section of the book that Greg Sestero is basically telling the story about this kid, which is obviously meant to be about Tommy Wiseau's backstory, like where he's from, but does it in a way like in the form of this tale of somebody else rather than Tommy Wiseau. And it's also like, you know, the struggles of their friendship, what it takes to be an actor and a filmmaker. And it's also a very inspiring story about resilience and to going out there and putting yourself on the line to follow your dreams and create something that's creative. And the way the book ends, it's like the perfect way to end it, that story, because it's just like before the movie blows up and becomes this big cult phenomenon.
And it's just to cut you off for a second, it's also the greatest book about what not to do when you want to make a film.
Exactly. Pretty much every, like I said, like Tommy Wiseau just went into this. They kept asking him, oh, do you want to shoot this on film? Do you want to shoot this on digital? And he's like, why not we shoot both? And then putting both the cameras side by side and shooting the movie. Because if you watch it, the movie looks different in most shots.
Right?
And also, yes, like going from like certain scenes being played out, he kept firing people because they weren't giving a good performance. Or he did in real life, people would go rent film equipment. He just went and bought film equipment. He didn't have to, but he did. But it is absolutely hilarious, and it is fascinating. Like, it is, like you say, Marcy, it's the how not to guide to make a movie, but at the same time, you can't help but be fascinated by everything that happens during the making of The Room, but also just getting caught up in the friendship between Tommy and Greg.
Yeah, like you, I adored the book. It was something I think I went through really quickly. Probably helped that, you know, for the book's release here, we had Greg Sestero doing like some screenings of The Room, doing Q&A, showed us a little documentary, book signings. I got to interview him back then as well. So it was such a great experience, like all of this signed book, but it was just such an incredible read. And as Greg Sestero told me, Tommy Wiseau calls it the Red Bible.
But yeah. Aaron, have you read the Disaster Artist book?
I haven't read the book. I've seen the film, and obviously I've seen The Room, both in the privacy of my own home and, of course, the way it is intended to be seen, which is in a room full of many, many, many people. But no, I need to read the book, because if there's even more to this story,
oh, there's more.
Bring it on. I'm so ready.
Yeah, like, as I said before, like, obviously you can't adapt everything from a book. So what the film puts in is just, like, I think main points. And there's, you know, obviously changing things to make it work into that film setting, but there's so much in there and you're just like...
Yeah. I also love any book that is about the making of a movie, let alone that is by people who are really, really close to the production. I just find them endlessly fascinating. I finally recently read the Jaws log by, oh gosh, I'm totally blanking on his name. Somebody will correct me about it. That was amazing. And I also recently read True Indie, the Don Coscarelli's autobiography. which is just this fly on the wall kind of retrospective about all of his films, and it was just incredibly insane.
Okay, I need this.
Yeah, True Indie is a kick-ass book, but I need to read this particular book. This sounds absolutely on my alley.
Yeah, it's certainly something.
Oh, definitely. And if anyone out there doesn't have the time to sort of sit down and read a book, definitely get the audiobook version as well, because Greg Sestero narrates it himself, and he also knows how to do a pitch-perfect impression of Tommy Wiseau when he does the voice.
He does.
Amazing. Look, hey, it's Christmas. I'm going to be doing a lot of driving to go see my family. I'm going to be cranking that shit real loud on my car ride.
And Marcy, what is your number two book that has changed your life?
Yeah, again, it was so difficult to narrow these down. But at the end of the day, like, yeah, lots of books have changed my life in certain ways. But yeah, this one kind of has a bizarre little backstory. If we're, you know, fortunate enough to have an upbringing where if you have both your parents or one parent, but they're encouraging you of your interests and whatnot. And one of the big things with my dad was films, but he has a very particular taste in movies and so forth. But one I used to see him watching growing up, I would only see bits and pieces. I had this memory of Sean Connery as a monk. And the film is The Name of the Rose. And I just knew it was one of his favorite things. And he'd talk about it a lot. And he'd talk about, you know, the book and the author. I can't remember how old I was. I could have been 12, 13. And I'm like, look, I want to watch the movie, but how about I read the book? So I think I went out with my dad. I picked up the book. It took me a little bit to read. I made sure I didn't know what was going on in it because I hadn't seen the movie properly or any really, just slightly bits of Sean Connery. And I'm reading this and it's got Latin in it. It is written in a way that can be hard to read, but it's also very engaging. And you're back in this, you know, hundreds of years ago, there's these monks, there's a mystery going on. And I was very engaged in this. And this is kind of like a book that it's like, if I can read and understand this, like there's lots of potential. And just kind of really being engrossed by this very interesting story. But maybe I was too clever for my own good, but I'm sitting there, I maybe got halfway through the book, having dinner with my parents. And I'm like, okay, so I'm in the middle of this book. Da, 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 and I'm like, so is this what's going to happen? And they both looked at each other because I was correct. And they're like, no, that's not it. And I knew, I'm like, I'm too smart for my own good. And that book was kind of the birth of Marcy guessing all the little twists and stuff. But yeah, it was a book that was kind of out of my comfort zone. Something so different. And I think in the way that it changed my life, it was like, just because something might not appear to be to your taste doesn't mean you should write it off completely. And to give things a chance. And I think I read it twice just because it was just so good. It was so different. It was very much unlike anything I'd read. So for me, that was like just something very different and unique. And again, like, then I watched the film and it's probably still one of my favorite films of all time. But anytime anyone asks me what my favorite books are, that's always on the list. And I probably wouldn't have been such a bookworm and all these things if I didn't take that chance to read it and kind of be like, okay, there's this whole thing in Latin. Let's try and translate this because I want to know what it means. And it just basically just helped make me even more of a nerd in a way.
I've read this one.
Hooray!
But I haven't read it since I was like 14 or something.
Yeah.
It's Umberto Eco, right? Is that how I say his name? Yeah. So I vividly, it's so funny hearing you talk about seeing snippets of the film on TV and stuff. I vividly, for years, remember seeing, because they must have shown In the Name of the Rose, like, on every station, every second night, because I felt like I had seen it but had no idea what it was.
Mm.
But I was attracted to, like, the mystery elements. It was actually a little bit frightening. It was very dark. There was lots of shadows. I remember asking my parents, what is this movie that's always on? My dad had the paperback, and I remember reading it and being really confused by all the Latin, but I remember just being immersed to it. And it was like one of three books that were very well read on my dad's shelf, and the other ones were The Godfather, Mario Puzo, and Dune by Frank Herbert. And I remember my parents saying, let him read it, he'll never finish it. He'll never finish it. And I did. And I was like, Dune, you're next. Dune, you're next. And Mario Puzo, I'm coming for you. So I know exactly what you're talking about in terms of that interest by osmosis turning into an obsession that kind of defines you. Totally, absolutely rings true.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, it's just so funny having these memories and remembering, like, a really young, underage, I might add, Christian Slater doing a few things in this movie, a bit controversial. But being a young kid and, you know, totally having a crush on Christian Slater, that definitely got my attention as well. But
who didn't have a crush on young Christian Slater at that age?
Like, everyone needed to. Everyone should have.
Did you have a crush on young Christian Slater?
I think I had more of a crush on Ron Perlman, but that's a completely different story right there.
Yeah, and I got to say, Ron Perlman, he plays Salvatore. I should know how to pronounce all these things. I'm Italian. It should be natural. I remember my dad just always going on about this performance, how good he is, blah, 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 blah. And then finding out, like, it's Ron Perlman, and then, you know, just kind of always being excited for something he's in.
Well, I haven't read the book myself, but I have seen the movie. It has been quite a while, so it's definitely one that I need to revisit.
Keep talking. I'm just going to – this isn't a visual podcast, but I'll probably post it on my socials when we bring out the episode. But I'll show you my book because it's very pretty.
Okay, we'll do that.
But you can continue talking.
Do it. Let's do it.
As I was saying, I haven't seen – I haven't read the book myself, but I have seen the movie, but it has been quite a while since I have seen the film. So I'll have to at some point, you know, check out the movie once again, but also read the book as well. So, because it seems like, yeah, you've both got a lot out of the book, and especially at quite a young age. So it'd be kind of curious to see how that book affects me, you know, for the first time, you know, being a lot older. But I can definitely see that regardless, though, what age you may be, it's going to still be a good book and a good read.
I can still remember holding it. I remember walking home from school and not looking where I was going because I was reading In the Name of the Rose. People must have been like, who the fuck is this kid? Like, what was he doing? I remember how yellowed the pages were. I remember it had that old book smell that is just so amazing, so spicy to some degree. My memories to this particular book, I never would have thought it would have conjured up these things, but they're very tactile memories for me. It's like reading on summer's days in the coldest room in the house. It's walking in summer to the pool with that book and trying to keep it in one part of my backpack and not in the part with like a wet towel. It's funny with these particular books, and I definitely felt it when you were saying to me, let's pick a subject. What about this one? When it comes to picking what they were, so much of it is remembering maybe even more what I was doing, where I was, and what I was feeling at the time when I read them.
Also, yeah, I can't find my book. I think it might have been, maybe it's in the other room.
Aaron, what is your number two book that has changed your life?
Oh, God, here we go. This is another one of those things. I was very young, and there's a movie connection to it, and it's through the common denominator here is my grandfather, who absolutely was like, check this out, Aaron. You might like this. He handed me a movie to watch. It was Psycho, and I watched Psycho, and I was like, this is the best thing I've ever seen in my life. I'm obsessed with this movie. I was obsessed with Psycho. Found out it was based on a book, and I picked up a copy of the book. And I read it like in a single sitting. The book was by Robert Bloch.
Mm.
20 or 22 years later, Robert Bloch wrote a sequel to Psycho called Psycho 2. And that book massively changed the way I thought what you can do with fiction. And it is a massive precursor to my number one pick. But my second pick is Psycho 2 by Robert Bloch. Now, like my first pick, which will be revealed. If I talk to people about this book, I get one of three responses. Read it and hated it. strongly. Never heard of it, but I know I've seen the movie Psycho 2, or I read it and it's fine. So Psycho 2, have we all seen Psycho 2, the movie?
Oh, yes. I am someone who loves the Psycho sequels as much as I love Psycho, okay. But I love Psycho 2. I have not read Psycho 2. No, haven't read them.
So, all right, this is the thing. This is
I know it's very different.
Super different. So basically, Robert Bloch invented almost the slasher genre in 1959 to some degree in terms of its structure and influence. And then within a year, Hitchcock cottoned on it and basically bought out every copy in existence in the hope that it would not give away the twist and put out the film. And honest to God, there is a lot of credit to Hitchcock, but everything in that movie that is successful is absolutely from the book in terms of like its influence, its structure, and even its punchlines. Mm. It's all there. All the set pieces are all there. The final line is exactly the same. So, and Robert Bloch wrote a wave of influence throughout the next 20 years. Mm. He had a career predating 20 years of that as well. And then he wrote Psycho 2. Universal Studios was like, he's writing a sequel to Psycho. Money, buy it, whatever it is, buy it, whatever you want. He handed them the completed manuscript and they read it voraciously and then politely closed the book and said, we shall not be making this movie, Mr. Bloch. But what we're going to do is we're going to go and make our own film. Mm. And then from that moment, the Psycho mythology branches off into two different directions. Mm. Where we get Psycho 2, the film, which is a terrific bloody movie, directed by Richard Franklin, written by Tom Holland. And then we got, Anthony Hopkins.
Perkins.
We've got Anthony Perkins directing Psycho 3. And then we've got Mick Garris coming up again, doing Psycho 4. Which I just love all of these films. But on the flip side of it, there are the Psycho books. Mm. There's Psycho 2. And then there is Psycho House, which is the third one. And then about like 5 or so years ago, there was Psycho Sanitarium, which was written by Chet Williamson, which bridges Psycho 1 and Psycho 2 in between. So it's like a bit of a prequel like in between. So not officially, but it's great. Psycho 2, is nothing like Psycho the movie and begins with Norman Bates in the sanitarium where he was locked up. Basically, he's got this psychologist named Dr. Claiborne. And he's like, I've got Norman ready to be discharged. He's this close, but Norman always keeps up kind of messing up just when he's getting close to being discharged. So he's like, probably never going to get out. And there are these nuns who come to visit Norman, and they kind of like, got their rosary beads and the whole habits and everything like that. And they're trying to, bring him around to Jesus and things like that. Norman kills these nuns, puts on the habit, and gets out and goes on the run. And on the run, he's heading to Hollywood, where they're making a movie based on his life story, which is obviously the details of Psycho. This book was written in like 1980, right? So this predates the scream, post-scream kind of metatextual kind of postmodern phase that will come. It even predates the introduction of the postmodern stuff that we started to see in like Friday the 13th Part 6, for example, or that would come with, Wes Craven's New Nightmare. This predates all of that. Mm. It's a Hollywood satire, and it absolutely is basically Scream 2. and it's Norman going to Hollywood, or so we think, potentially, to stop the feature that's going to be made about his film. And it has the construct of a slasher film told from the perspective of the psychologist who is like, oh gosh, Norman's on the run, and I'm going to go there to try to intercept it. And all the people who are playing the central characters from the original Psycho, because Robert Bloch in his later years, this is Robert Bloch's Old Man Yells at Cloud novel, and it just happens to be absolutely spectacularly weird and kinky and gory and messed up, full-on slasher insanity. He kind of is criticizing slashers, but also is writing one, so he gets to have his cake but eat it too. Mm. It's so delicious, and it has got a twist that blew my mind. And I think it was the twist that kind of taught me a lesson. I am absolutely fascinated with sequels. I'm fascinated with the idea of messing with legacies, and that will lead me to my first choice. But I was just obsessed with this book. And off the back of reading Psycho 2, I wanted to read everything Robert Bloch read. And I have the entire collection. It's like the one thing I'm nerding about. If they like my Robot Bot collection is like that. That's my Funko Pops. You know what I mean? That's my equivalent of my absolute nerdism. And if my house burns down, I will carry that entire bookshelf out, like, you know, on my back, kind of dragging it down the street, because that's the thing that I value most. I've got signed editions. I just started an obsession. And then part of that obsession is the obsessive hunt for the bits of that collection that you don't have. And now that I have them, I mourn the hunt. Like, there's no more. Like, this is a huge, huge collection of stuff. And because I don't have anything else to track down, I'm kind of sad. And I feel as though I've outgrown Psycho 2 as a novel in terms of its influence. I've read it maybe 3 or 4 times, but I kind of miss the kid I was when I read that and was like, wow, books can be total trash and high art at the same time. And so that is something that I like to play with in my own stuff as well. So that's why I thought I'd pick this one. And it's, do you know what, guys? It's so weird. Like, Sylvester Stallone putting lipstick on his face in a mirror, weird, like sequences of surrealism where you're like, okay, this is Mulholland Drive style weird, full on Hollywood underground, like, you know, like Harvey Weinstein kind of, you know, sexual exploitation behind the scenes, people bringing their trauma into the workplace, people bringing the workplace into their trauma, and all of this stuff kind of bleeding together in a psych, a whirlpool of psychosis, but also having the appeal of a pulp novel and like the fun of a tawdry slasher. Super, super fun. Psycho 2, nothing like the movies. Love the movies, but this is so different.
You've convinced me to go read it.
I was going to say, you pretty much have sold me on this book.
Right?
And again, this is not, and we can absolutely cut this out, but I do have my copy here, right? One of the best covers I've ever seen in my life. Are you ready?
Let's see.
Oh, I like
that. I love this. Okay.
So these are like little cutouts.
Yeah, like, I can, you know, see the to kind of like the to like those paper doll things. Yeah.
They're like little paper dolls. And then you flip over to the other side and you've got the nun and you've got Norman. So you can cut it out and copy and paste and make your own little Norman identity. So and it's not I defy you. Pick the ending of this book. And then when the ending comes, you're like, this is written by the guy who wrote fucking Psycho. This guy knows exactly what he's doing, and he played me like a fiddle. And it's not like there's some sort of huge revelation here, that, but it's absolutely, it's structured so robustly. And that's the great thing about Block, and that's the lesson that I took away, and that's how it shaped me as a writer, is that you can play your audience, but don't let them know they're being played. And I love that feeling of like, damn, you got me, book. You got me. So good stuff.
Yeah, I think I need to get this book right now.
Yeah, I've always wanted to actually read Psycho, so I think I got an excuse to just read both back to back or something.
Also, read Psycho. Psycho is unequivocally like a terrific book, you know, and it is, again, I won't spoil it for too much, but the twist that we all know and love from Psycho is impossible to pick in the original one because it's in the book, because it's told he is having those chats with his mum in the same room, and he's a very different type of character. He's very kind of like schlubby, like he's kind of he's a little bit like Philip, he's passed away.
Philip Seymour Hoffman.
He's a little bit like Philip Seymour Hoffman in Happiness, if you've ever seen Happiness.
Yes,
like,
I have.
Depressed, you know, kind of oppressive, sexually confused and explicit creeper who has this overbearing mother who is just kind of infantizing him in every capacity. And there are actually 3 dominant personalities. There's Norman, as we know, and there's Norman as a child who has never grown up, and then there's also Norman in the mother. Really interesting stuff. So Robert Block, a master who and you know, there's the great Stephen King line, which he often says, which is that, you know, yeah, Stephen King would say, yeah, I've got the heart of a child. I keep it in, you know, in a jar on my desk. Well, that's a Robert Block line. And King always credited Block with that as well. But that was, you know, that was Robert Block, because he also would describe something utterly, utterly horrific, and then he would end it with a pun. And it's so disarming that somebody would end a sequence of horror with a pun. And to be honest, that's what he does with the shower scene in the book. It's so, so, so clever. Good stuff.
Gonna have to get onto it.
Indeed. And speaking of Stephen King, It's a good segue into my number two pick, the second book that has changed my life. And that, of course, is the classic It by Stephen King. Funnily enough, the very first Stephen...
I've never heard of it.
I actually have never read it.
See, this book is the very first Stephen King book I've ever read. And I've seen a lot of the film adaptations throughout the years. Like, I've tried to read bits and pieces of other King stuff over the years, but I just never sort of had the time to sit down and properly read. So when I knew, like, the new films were coming out, it's like, you know what? I need to sit down and actually read, like, it in the lead up. And I did. And one of the things that really struck me the most about it, and what I think made me realize why Stephen King is such a great writer and why a lot of people love him, is not only because of, you know, his focus on characters, like how he knows how to develop characters, how to give every character their own kind of traits and identity, so they all feel distinct. Because he knows, as when it comes to horror, the only way you're going to care about what's going on and be terrified about what's going on is that you got to have characters that you either care about or characters that you are completely repelled by. And he knows how to create them very distinctly. But I think as well is how descriptive of a writer he is. Like, some writers, when you read their books, they like kind of keep things simple, like simple in terms of like what is happening, the details of what is happening in a scene, and that it, like, the, you know, the core of like the room that they're in. But Stephen King, he can do at least 5 to 10 pages describing like somebody's room to every fine detail.
Well, that's what is so compelling about King, is that, you know, it is a very chunky book. That's probably why I haven't actually read it, which is weird for me being a Stephen King fangirl. But then he can make a fucking excellent complete story in like 5 pages.
Oh yeah, definitely.
Dude, fuck off. Where's my talent like that?
Exactly. Exactly. But I think as well is like with it, he does a great job of creating these two separate parallel stories. Like, you got the first story, of course, with the group of kids, the Losers Club, and how their town is being affected by the evil shape-shifting clown Pennywise.
I thought you were going to say it was Republicans.
Well, that too, but that's beside the point.
That's a terrible joke. Yes.
It was an easy joke, but we will allow it on the show.
I don't apologize for my terrible jokes.
But then, of course, you have the characters. We follow the same kids about 27 years later as adults, and they're kind of gone off living their own lives. And then once they get the word that Pennywise is back, it kind of like their memories of the events that happened to them as kids come flooding back. And I love the fact that with this book, it really does, King does a really good job at sort of doing the parallels back and forth between the two of them, almost like they're simultaneously happening at the same time. Like, events in one, say in the past, are also happening at a specific point in the present. Also, how he goes into the backstory of characters and also the history of the town of Derry as well. Like, he really gives you a full picture of life in this town and how this one demonic creature, like this alien creature from, you know, another dimension, has come into this town and has inflicted its evil onto the town, and how it's spread throughout the centuries, and how it affects everyone and everything. Like, he does such a great job at doing that, and also going completely batshit bonkers as well, because, you know, at a certain point during the book, in the last half, Pennywise turns into a giant fucking spider, and there's also a giant turtle from another dimension also makes an appearance as well, and also one very controversial scene in the book. And I'm like sitting there, I'm like, why did Stephen King write this scene? Why is this included? I don't like this. This is making me very uncomfortable.
Like, cocaine is a hell of a drug beat.
Well, that is true. And thank goodness that scene has never been in any adaptation of this book. Thank goodness. And it's just such a great book. Like, even though it is a very big, long book, and I know the audiobook is like at least 30 hours or more, it is a great read. You just can't help but be fully invested from the very beginning. And of course, once she had the most famous scene in the book, which of course is, you know, the scene where Pennywise meets Georgie, like in the drain, like one of the most quintessential scenes in all of horror, whether it's literature or film, like it just grabs you and you just are enthralled from beginning to end. And it's also a very dark book. It also deals with a lot of themes about childhood, coming of age, but also dealing with, you know, racism and other, like, homophobia and other, you know, themes that, you know, that if children go through, but also adults go through, and also domestic violence as well. Like, it is, it, this book covers everything. And it does, and King does such a great job at covering all these different things and somehow making it a complete cohesive story without it feeling like an absolute mess, which it could possibly have been. And he just does a great job at like writing it in this very big, epic horror novel.
Yeah. I mean, I still need to read it at some point.
It's so good. I love it. I've read it. And you know, controversial opinion. This is not about the book itself, but hey, Tim Curry, amazing. Bill Skarsgård, amazing. The best person who has embodied the spirit of Pennywise most is Steven Weber, who did the audiobook of it for like 45 hours.
I didn't realize he did that.
It is a work of performative art. He is spectacular. Because he follows that embodiment through in a way that neither the TV films or the cinematic films ever did, which was that it went into that insane cosmic otherworldly element with the turtle and everything else, and he follows that through, and there's this continuity. The performance is just insanely good. I look, but that's a recommendation for it, the audiobook. I don't know how to describe it. Maybe the reason I think that it is so utterly compelling is that because in its structure, it's like a train. It is industrial in its structure. It is, I'm going to provide you a circle, which is going to give me a story and a setting, and then it's going to shift to the next character. We're going to go through this exact same thing, and I'm going to keep propelling this thing through like this, like a slinky of trauma, over and over again from character to character. And then at the same time, I'm going to do the exact same thing in the past. And these two kind of things I'm overlapping, like this in this locomotive of fear that is just building and building and building, and it does not stop. And it covers exactly like you're saying, every social ill. I remember massively being like, it gives, you know, on its structure level, like you think of horror novels, right, or horror movies, and it's very, very easy because we're kind of so in love with horror movies is that you've got your opening sequence and then you've got your credit card and then you've got your now I'm going to start with act one beginning. It's like the plot structure to Scream, which I love, right? Well, the novel has two introductions. It's got the Georgie sequence, but then it's also got the reintroduction of It the Clown in Derry in the 80s involved with this awful act of homophobia. And these two things running. So it's like this double bang. It's like every beat that you normally get in a horror novel, you get punched twice by King in this book. And so you're continuously feeling like you're just getting slapped around. It's a real assault of a book. And you keep on going, hit me again, Steve. Uncle Steve, smash me up a little bit harder. Like, you know, and do it for 1,000 pages. And then at the end, turn into a spider and give me your cosmic turtle. I'm all yours. It's like this ultimate act of reader submissiveness. It's so amazing.
I do
That's
love...
my experience with it.
I do love the... kind of the influences on King with a lot of sort of that Lovecraftian cosmic horror type of stuff. Like, yeah, I do really love the works of H.P. Lovecraft, piece of shit human being. But that the, sort of the writing and the stuff that he did and how King kind of takes that, but it's his own thing. Like, it's beautiful stuff.
Have you both read Revival?
No, I haven't. No. I have the audio book, but I hear it's definitely one of his best recent books, but also it's also another one that deals with a lot of cosmic horror. And it's also his Frankenstein book in a way as well.
It is. It's his Frankenstein book. It is his cosmic horror novel. And I'm not even going to go into it other than to say that only three times has King ever made me kind of close a book and sit there and have a really good hard think about what I'm doing in my life. And the Pet Sematary did that to me at that scene. We all know what happens. Like, there's a crossroads in Pet Sematary and a literal road that did it. There was a sequence in Gerald's Game where somebody realizes they're not alone in the room that made me close the book and go, do I really want to read this? Because I'm actually quite frightened. And the last 15 or so pages of Revival made me close it and go, I don't know if I can finish this because I'm so upset. And it's an astronomical thing, but it taps into the cosmic stuff that's in it, but it does it through a far more Lovecraftian way, only without the racism. So bring it on.
Exactly. And well, we come to our final round. So Marcy, before you tell us your number one book that has changed your life, do you have any little honorable mentions you want to quickly mention?
It's so hard because I can't remember shit. Honestly, look, volumes of H.P. Lovecraft stories, just, you know, like I said, shit human being, fantastic writer. Lovecraft has, you know, just been something I'd gotten into. It was something I bonded a lot with a friend of mine, a B2, sadly passed away a few years ago, but I have, like, her Cthulhu, I can't say the name properly. I have a design on my leg as a, you know, a symbol of that. Where's my shelf? Jesus. You know, honestly, like, this might be just a bit about authors, but honestly, like, Fear Street books from R.L. Stein just fully got me into that horror. I kind of do like revisiting or looking at Goosebumps because I didn't read too much of the Goosebumps. I'm kind of a bit older. And honestly, if I was six, I probably would have been like, it's not quite scary enough for me. No, not really. Massive shout out to a couple of like biographies. Mick Foley, the professional wrestler, his first book. It's an incredible piece of writing. It's such an interesting story of someone's journey at really as the underdog to get into a business that they were so passionate about, but also the injuries and all sorts of things. Like, it's just like an incredible book that even if you're not into wrestling, like, it's so fucking interesting. Just wow. Bruce Campbell's book, If Chins Could Kill. Like, I've read the shit out of that. I loved it.
Amazing.
Yeah.
I've read that twice. I love it. Yeah.
It's so good. It's just so good. Again, it's like, it's a really great book on, you know, coming up in that industry, how he got into it, how the fuck they made Evil Dead and all these things. Like, it's guerrilla filmmaking. I mean, another book I can't remember the title. It is a film-related book. Raging Bulls and something else.
Easy Riders and Raging
Bulls.
That's
it. That was Easy Riders. These amazing. Are just things off the top of my head that I remember really enjoying reading. The Wizard of Oz, again, just one of my favorite books. Alice in Wonderland. I could be here forever just naming all these things. But they are just among some of my favorite things. But my number one, and this is probably my number one favorite book, favorite everything, really, probably has been since I was about 11. And Babe knows exactly what it is. It is Different Seasons by Stephen King. This is my original, original that I'm holding up on camera that no one else can see. I think my name's written in there somewhere. Oh, yeah, in my 11-year-old handwriting. And I also have this big, massive hardback, which you can't really see at the moment.
No, that it's one. The paperback. Oh, I've got the one. Paperback. And
this one.
Yeah, and my name's written in it as well. In my God. Like, you know, 14-year-old handwriting.
Were we separated at birth or something? What's going on? When I was in the US over 10 years ago, I saw this at the one of those antique shops, $250. I'm like, you know what? I really want a hardback of it. And I think it's King on the back with his son.
But is that Joe Hill, the famous author in his own right?
It could be. Oh, another book speaking of Joe Hill, I've only read one of his books, which was Horns, and I fucking loved that. Horns, it was so great.
It's so good.
Oh, so such a great book.
But why do you love Different Seasons, Marcy?
Look, Different Seasons, I'm going to have to hold it like a presentation. Okay, so when I was really young, my parents used to watch Stand By Me a lot. And then I used to just watch it like, yeah, it's okay, whatever. You understand, like, you don't speak like these kids, rah, rah, rah. I still told my parents, I don't shut up, I grow up. And when I look at you, I throw up. But they had that coming. So, yeah, like Stand By Me is my favorite movie of all time. There is just so much of who I am, who I was in that film. It means so much to me. And Bede can attest, like, we did cover it on our King Zone podcast. I rewatched it. I hadn't watched it for a little bit. I was a blubbering mess. I think I almost was crying on the podcast talking about it. I'm going to cry now almost. But yes, Different Seasons is four novellas by King. Represents different things. So the novella that Stand By Me is based on is in this book. It's called The Body. But also in this is Rita Hayworth and The Shawshank Redemption, which they adapted into The Shawshank Redemption. The other one in there, which we've also discussed on The King Zone, is The Apt Pupil, bit of a controversial film now. And I do believe there is some kind of adaptation coming of the other story that's in there called The Breathing Method. Originally, I just picked this up because I wanted to read where Stand By Me came from. But then I ended up reading everything and, Shawshank Redemption, again, one of my favorite films of all time. And with how much like Stephen King I've watched and whatnot, I do actually think that those two films, Shawshank and Stand By Me, captured something and added more to what was written onto the screen. And the changes that they made just made the films flow in such a way. But it's not to say that they're shit novellas. They're fucking brilliant novellas. It's just this amazing thing that just happened to be like Frank Darabont just got it. Rob Reiner just got it. I do believe, like King has said, like he thinks Stand By Me is better than what he's written. For me, I just think it's different. It's done in a different way. But specifically reading The Body, which I've read so many times, like this was Stephen King as a kid. Like you can see this, he's used so much of what happened to him. Like he's Gordy in this story and what he went through. And I just really related to this quiet kid who just wanted to be a writer. That was me. I wanted to be a writer. You know, my best friend when I was 12 was like, kind of the bad one that people would say is a bad influence, da, da, da. Like everything, I just felt so relatable. There are moments that I just cry, whether it's in the film or the book, because I'm like, I've been in this situation. I know this. Like Stephen King understands my soul. It's such an incredible coming of age story. And it's just, it hits me so profound because the novella kind of goes into more of what happens after that, and there are things that just I think back on now, like the people that come and go through your lives, like these things just hit me hard, and I think it's just something that means that much to me. And then looking at the Shawshank, Rita Hayworth and the Shawshank Redemption, it's such an intriguing story in itself. And while in the novella, like your main character of Andy goes through different wardens where they change that in the film. But in this context and seeing like most of the same things happen and whatnot, but it's such an interesting and captivating story that you're really behind this character. And as you kind of go through it, like you really want the good to happen. And I feel like they really captured that kind of stuff with the film as well. But it's, such a it's like such an interesting read, and it's not so much like horror in that traditional King sense. And that's what I feel like all of these kind of have. It's different kind of horrors. And Apt Pupil was just something I wasn't expecting. You know, the sort of tagline for it, because they're sort of named after different seasons. So I'll just go over it. Like, hope springs eternal for Rita Hayworth and The Shawshank Redemption, because hope is what you have in that writing. And that's the big theme in the film. Summer of Corruption, Apt Pupil, we definitely understand why. And it's a very shocking story, but it's so just, it's written in such a strong way. It almost kind of reminded me of like reading Catcher in the Rye in a way, this very weird thing. Fall from Innocence is the Body, which really is your coming of age. You're not a kid anymore. And A Winter's Tale with the breathing method, which I'm so curious how they could adapt that. It is one of the strangest stories I've ever read, but I think it's utterly brilliant in what it does. If people haven't read it, I don't want to spoil things too much, like just experience them. But yeah, I think because I've had this book since I was very young, it just, honestly, it's something that's just made me who I am. Without this, I wouldn't be me. So that's mine. And I don't know if you guys have actually read them. I'm sure you've seen the films, though.
You first, Sarah.
Yeah, okay, cool.
Clearly you have, because you have this.
I have the exact same paperback copy, and my little kind of 14-year-old handwriting,
right,
which looks like a serial killer, you know, has like, you know, scrawled it in crayon, basically. I have the exact same copy. I have the exact same feelings for all of these stories. I admittedly need to reread The Breathing Method because I don't remember it as much. I haven't read it in probably 20 years. But let's look at, say, Apt Pupil, right? That is a extraordinarily robust piece of fiction, and is probably the most Richard Bachman thing that he ever wrote without the pseudonym. And it's so ugly and yet so involving that it makes you, it synthesizes the sense of guilt just reading it. And then the movie, I actually think, has like, yes, there's scene stuff that is very, very kind of queasy, but there is a lot in that film that is in very, very kind of like, it gets it right. But the movie stops, the novella continues, and the third act of that novella is incredibly disturbing. So I've never forgotten it. I was really rattled by it. Shawshank Redemption is obviously what we know, but when it comes to the body is my childhood. I feel it. The horror of the body is that the most perfect, seemingly eternal things in your life all fade. It is the rot of our flesh as personified in this body. It is the summer that they are experiencing that is fading away. And it is the friendships that they think will last forever but don't.
Yeah.
And it is about the body as a temple, but as the temple will always crumble because time will win. And that's why I think that the most closest thing that King ever wrote to the body is The Langoliers. I think that there is a cosmic interplay to those two things, to those two stories, that is about the exact same thing, which is that none of us get out of this alive. So we need to fight to make the most of it whilst we can. And the way we honor people is through telling their stories. And I love, more than all the other, you know, stuff, that the kid in the body wants to be a writer. And it just makes my soul sing, the body. I think it's beautiful. I think it's utterly, utterly beautiful. It's great. And the movie is spectacular. So, so good. Well done, Rob Reiner and William Goldman. You guys got
really,
it.
Really, truly.
You did the... You read your homework. You got the assignment, A+.
Yeah, they got the assignment and then went, no, we're going way over this. Like, let's go. Honestly, Stand By Me is just my favorite film of all time. I am that character. I feel like I've always been a Gordy. Therefore, I'm always a Stephen King, I suppose. But yeah, having that being, you know, my absolute favorite film since I was like maybe 6, 7, to getting that book, but to embracing and reading the other stories, just honestly changed me. And that led me to read more Stephen King stuff. Like you mentioned before, I think I was in year 7, so I must have been 12. My friend bought me a Stephen King book for my birthday. I was reading it on our off time in class. A different teacher from our year level comes in and goes, "What are you doing reading that? Put that away. You shouldn't be having that." And I'm like, "Really?" I'm just sitting there like, pfft. And then my teacher comes along and is like, no, she's fine. She gets it. You know, why would we discourage reading just because of who the author is, that it's the horror author? Like, my teacher stood up for me over that because I was always novels. But yeah, that other teacher, I'm like, really? You had me last year and you're telling me off for this? Piss off. In young Marcy's head, I said that, not out loud. Mm-hmm. But yes, there's my love fest for Stephen King and my childhood.
Indeed. And Aaron, what is your number one book that has changed your life? But do you have any honorable mentions you want to quickly mention?
Clearly, it's going to be The Hungry, Hungry Caterpillar.
It's totally The Hungry, Hungry Caterpillar. It's funny you should say that because there's a link. Okay. Ooh. I'll come back to it. Honorable mentions, there are thousands. There are thousands upon thousands. Rapid fire, Jack Ketchum's The Girl Next Door blew my socks off. I knew I wanted to be a writer, but it wasn't until I read The Girl Next Door that I realized I'm allowed to write the stuff that I want to write.
Something I have actually read.
It's full on. A lot of my stuff does kind of tend into going into that. The dark pursuit of empathy is something that Ketchum does amazingly. That's why I dedicated Cut to Care to him. So yeah, the Cut to Care is dedicated to Jack Ketchum, Dallas, which is his real name, and also to Everett DeRoche, who wrote like Road Games and things like that. So I dedicated it to both those guys. I wanted to definitely can't go further without talking about Clive Barker, his influence and the way he opened my mind. Imagica is the greatest piece of like fantasy fiction I've ever read. And when we talk about like every it's like sexuality as a Rubik's cube, and it twists and turns in a like in a way of like encapsulating every facet of sexuality that I can even think of. It's the sexiest book. It's fascinating. It's fluid, and it's brilliant and mind expanding. That was amazing. A book that was really, really important to me growing up was a piece of tie-in fiction, and it was The Secret Diary of Laura Palmer, which was a Twin Peaks tie-in novel, which was written by Jennifer Lynch. And it is the diary of Laura Palmer leading up to her death. And it is an extraordinary piece of literature. You wouldn't think so, but it is profoundly moving portrait about a young girl who wants to be believed and who is trying to get the adults around her to believe that she's being sexually assaulted by her father. And it is incredibly confronting and incredibly apparently autobiographical from Jennifer Lynch in terms of talking to other people about other people in her life, nothing to do with her family. But the other one was James Herbert's The Rats was like a huge mind blower when I was a kid. I was like, wow, books are allowed to be fucked up and messy. Loved it. And a really recent one is... it's not even out yet. It comes out in February, but I listened to it anthologized through his podcast in the lead up to the publication, which is Bret Easton Ellis's upcoming novel, The Shards, which is the best piece of fiction I have consumed in years. It is metafiction. It's about Bret Easton Ellis as a teenager in Los Angeles and all of his friends in high school, all of whom existed. And real reality blending with what might be fictional recounts of a serial killer. It is an extraordinary piece of fiction. And it was like the anchor point of the year that it was anthologized through COVID on his podcast. It absolutely kept me alive, it felt like. And the only other thing I wanted to kind of in the honorable mentions category is that I actually read a series of books this year that I think genuinely did change my life. I didn't add it to my number one spot, although it easily could be. And it's a series of books by Larry McMurtry. And the first book is called The Last Picture Show, which is made into an amazing film. Which is just one of the greatest films ever made. The sequel is called Texasville. The third one is called Dwayne's Depressed. The fourth one, I think, is called, Where the Light Goes. And I think the last one's called Rhino Ranch. I loved these books. They're literally about life in Texas. It's a coming of age and then coming of middle age and then becoming old, and then watching all your friends die and then reconciling the fact that you're going to die. And it's written over a 40-year period, and it's absolutely astronomically profound. And I can't even talk about it without getting teary. That's how good this thing was. But it's not my number one. My number one comes back to The Hungry, Hungry Caterpillar, and it's a sequel. And it is a book that taught me a lesson. And I love this lesson, and I've never forgotten it. And even though I don't love the book and what it does, I love what it did to me and how it changed me. And the book is Hannibal by Thomas Harris.
He is a hungry, hungry caterpillar.
He is a hungry, hungry caterpillar. And most people hate this book, but I've read it maybe 8 times. I was so looking forward to reading the sequel to The Silence of the Lambs that when it was released, it must have been released like in November. Let's say it was November of that year. I remember my mum knew how obsessed I was with who was reading, cutting articles out of the books. I'm like, I can't wait to read the sequel to The Silence of the Lambs. What's going to happen? Oh my God, it's going to be amazing. And my mum had it wrapped up for Christmas, which was a whole month away. And anyway, she sat me down after I'd watched the Today Show going, oh, they're interviewing all these people about it, blah, blah, blah. And she's like, Aaron, I know you really want to read this book. I actually have it for Christmas. If you promise me you won't tell your father, you can unwrap it now and read it, but you've only got 2 days, and then we'll wrap it back up and we'll put it back under the tree and just pretend to be surprised on Christmas morning. And I did it, and I read it, and I closed that book, and I didn't know what to think. Do you both know how the ending of Hannibal? Do you know what happens in the ending of Hannibal?
I haven't read Hannibal. Actually, with those books, I've only read Red Dragon, which I've probably read twice.
The ending of Hannibal, I think we're beyond the point of spoilers. I think it's become this mythological thing, but in the end of Hannibal, the book, if you've seen the film, and they tap onto this into the TV series, they really explore it extensively in the TV series. But in the film ends, boom, all this stuff happens. So in the book, it continues for about another 80 pages in which Hannibal Lecter has captured Clarice Starling and through a series of drugs, hypnosis, burying up her dead father, regression therapy, and also attuning her state of psychosis to certain sounds. He tricks her into basically thinking that he is in love with her, and maybe she actually kind of is. And he takes her abroad, and it ends with them essentially in love and partaking in cannibalistic acts together. And suffice to say, this was not the book that 15-year-old Aaron was ready or expected to read. And I remember closing the book and feeling a hollow pit in my stomach. And it was the first time I'd ever experienced profound literary disappointment. It was just so far from where I thought that this book was going to go. And I sat on it. And when Christmas came around and I opened it up, I faked my smile and I sat through it. And then on Christmas Day, once everyone else had fallen asleep for naps after they'd gorged themselves on food, I opened it up and I started to reread it again. And it changed my life. And it absolutely changed my life. It made me realize that, do you know what? The reader doesn't matter. That the book is boss. And an author has the right to break you and to poke you, provoke you any way that he wants. And that this is about a misalignment between my expectations and what an author wants to do to you. Red Dragon is a story. The Silence of the Lambs is Clarice's story. This book is called Hannibal. It is absolutely his world and his vibe. And it is this Greco-Roman Italian tragedy, you know, with these you know, reproductions of art and these grotesque Baroque kind of Grand Guignol, like, you know, you know, sequences, and it absolutely started to click with me. And then that ending became the most influential. Those 80 pages, which I've studied and pulled apart, has become the most influential thing. So it made me realize that it doesn't matter what I think, that the book absolutely has the right to break me. And I've wanted to pursue that to some degree through what Harris does, which is through a masterful command of his craft. And so it's a book that I've pulled apart sentence by sentence to look at the mechanics of it. And it is there are things that Thomas Harris does in that book. It's told in the third person past tense, but when he wants to scare you, he changes that. He breaks the rules of literary fiction and he shifts to present tense so that it makes the character jump forward. So it looks like he's looking you in the eye, and it makes you want to push the book away from you. It's this incredible dance between repulsion and attraction, which is absolutely what's happening to Hannibal and Clarice. And I love what it does in terms of working with fairy tales. Hannibal is Beauty and the Beast. The Silence of the Lambs is Little Red Riding Hood. There are elements of Red Dragon that are Blackbeard. Bluebeard, sorry. You know, and it's just, I love his intertextuality, and this book taught me what I can do. And so it gave me permission to do things. And I've been chasing that dragon for a long time, and if I can't find it, I'm going to write it. That's what it taught me. And that's how it changed me. And most people hate it, but that's okay. They're allowed to.
Exactly. I mean, I haven't read it myself. I do actually have all three of Robert Harris's Hannibal books, at least the first three. I don't have Hannibal Rising. But yeah, like, I remember even just like reading most of Silence of the Lambs and just sort of seeing like, oh, the film, it's pretty much almost word for word. The movie is pretty much word for word from the book, like from the dialogue and everything. Yeah. But I always knew, like, with Hannibal, the movie adaptation was very different in a lot of ways from the book. And I guess given like that most people had a mixed reception to the book, either people really liked it or hated it and they had to change things. But I've always been curious to kind of sit down and read the book. And now that I do actually have the book somewhere around here, I'll have to sit down and give that a proper read as well.
Have you seen the TV show? Have you ever watched the TV show?
Oh yeah, I've seen the first two seasons. I still haven't.
Yeah, I haven't seen the third season yet. I'm terrible.
So the third season, basically, the halfway through the second season, they start to, because it's a mishmash. It's like this beautiful kind of really super gay, queer kind of reinterpretation of, like, you know, the Hannibal Lecter mythology. And that halfway through season two, they start to incorporate all the stuff about the Mason Verger, who is this insane character. Like, how do you write a novel where Hannibal Lecter isn't the bad guy, but actually becomes the person you cheer for? You introduce somebody so grotesque that you're going to pivot and see him as the bad guy, and that's Mason Verger. So they incorporate that stuff into the first part of season two, and then the second part of season three is the ending of Hannibal. Like, the stuff they thought was unfilmable when Ridley Scott made that film that everyone pushed back against, they actually filmed it, which incorporates, just saying, sequences like, I'm going to get semen from my brother by putting a cattle prod up his ass. Or, for example, I'm going to be able to choke somebody with a giant eel. And they did it for NBC. It's just, we've come far. We've come really, really far, I think. You know. And look, all jokes aside, I still really like the film Hannibal. I think that Ridley Scott was just like, today I'm going to be just a little bit indulgent, and I'm going to go for broke. And I actually think it's a fucking spectacular film. The Italy sequences are just gorgeous. And I think Julianne Moore is somebody who absolutely kind of embodies what a broken person actually is. And that's the thing that people were really upset about with Hannibal outside of the ending, is that it begins with our hero in disgrace, in utter disgrace. And that it is the screaming of a lamb that brings the wolf in running. And that lamb essentially is Clarice. She's become the thing she tried to save. She's in a hole and she's put there by bastard men who absolutely pushed her down within a professional context for 10 years. And want to talk about cannibalism? The cannibalism at the center of the Hannibal Lecter novels is not Hannibal Lecter. It's about the men who push down innovation through women in workforces, especially when they're bureaucratic. That's the cannibalism that happens. They feed off young females. And that's why the FBI in Hannibal and the Silence of the Lambs is such a powerful metaphor for consumption, because it feeds off those young and will throw them away if there's no use from it. That's where this book begins. It's actually really, it's so terribly upsetting. And I think that Julianne Moore absolutely nails that. She looks broken. She has a broken quality to her. And maybe Jodie Foster wouldn't necessarily do that. She might have kept it too strong.
Mm.
I don't know. We'll see. I don't know.
The only thing I don't like about Hannibal is the brain eating. R.I.P. Ray Liotta. That I can't do anything with brains and eyeballs, and that traumatized me because I was eating dinner when I watched that movie. Don't ask me why. I was a fucking idiot. Usually I'm fine. I'm not squeamish, but that got to me.
I remember Hannibal. Because I read the book, I was obsessed with it. And the film was coming out, and it was here in Australia. I must have been like the ninth. It was MA, and then they changed it to R-rated like a week later. Because of appeals in the streets. Yep. And like a week later, and I scraped in by one day. I was like,
"See, yes. I went to go see it with my friend. We got 20 minutes into the movie. We're wondering why there's no dialogue. They fucked up something. They had to restart the movie. We were so pissed off. We're like, you know what? Let's just wait till it's on video or whatever. I'm like, can we just go see something else? And like, Almost Famous is starting. You can go into that cinema. Fucking great decision, because that movie's fucking amazing. So that's my Hannibal.
Your aura is so purple. I love Almost Famous. I love that. Like, if I can't do Hannibal, I'll do Cameron Crowe's Almost Famous. I think that is a happy compromise. Any day of the week.
Yeah, by the end of the movie, I'm sitting there like this. And my friend's like, who are you waving to? And I'm like, no one. I'm not saying goodbye to Billy Crudup or anything.
Look, if we can say goodbye to Billy Crudup, but we can also say goodbye to Ray Liotta. R.I.P., my friend. Your brain.
R.I.P.
What a wonderful performance your brain gave at the ending of Hannibal.
Yeah. And Bede.
Indeed.
Up to you.
Bede, yes, let's do it.
All right.
I also left out quite a few honorable mentions, but I'm not going to get into it. Just whatever.
All right. Well, I'll go quickly through my. Yeah. Well, I'll quickly go through my little honorable mentions very quickly. First up, of course, is The Woman in Black by Susan Hill. Great ghost story. Good old fashioned gothic ghost story. That's actually extremely creepy. Next up, of course, is I think the book that everyone had to read when they were in high school, Looking for Ella Brandy. That's by Melina.
I love Looking for Ella Brandy. I love it.
Also, Reckoning by Magda Sabansky, her biography. That one's a great, great read, especially when she goes into her backstory that her dad was actually an assassin during World War II, and also about her discovering about her own sexuality as well. So it's like a great read if you haven't read that one. Wake and Fright by Kenneth Cook.
Good one.
That's so good.
That is a great book. That the movie is pretty faithful to, like the original 70s film. Also, what I don't know if that many people have read this book. I read this one in school. It's a young adult novel called Tunes for Bears to Dance To by Robert Cormier. Great book.
I'm so glad you didn't say chlamydia, because that's what I thought you said. I apologize to that author.
I'll be but it's actually a great book that I read in school, because it's a story about this young boy who befriends a Holocaust survivor, so they form a friendship, and as the survivor, what he does to cope with what happened to him during the Holocaust is that he creates this entire village from scratch, like this toy village of that's similar to the one he grew up with that was destroyed during the war. And then, of course, the young boy's boss at work has a massive hatred for Jewish people and actually tries to force the kid to go to destroy this toy village. And it's a very powerful story that explores anti-Semitism, and it's definitely one I think everyone should can definitely give a read. It has been quite a long time since I read it, because like I was a young teenager when I read this book, but it's definitely a good read. But since this is a movie, this book is one that goes into racism. My number one favorite book of all time, the one that has changed my life, is also a book that kind of deals with it. And that, of course, is the classic To Kill a Mockingbird by Harper Lee. I mean, what can I say about this book that hasn't already been said like a billion times by a lot of people?
Probably nothing.
Yeah, exactly. I'm just going to end the podcast right here.
Yeah.
Kill a Mockingbird. Go read it. but seriously, though, it is an amazing book that really dives into racism, prejudice. And it also has probably one of the greatest characters in all of literature, which, of course, is Atticus Finch, who is this lawyer in this small country town who definitely wants to do the right thing. And he is someone who definitely believes that his client did not rape the woman that he was charged with, and that this is all racially motivated. And he does whatever it takes to free this man, but also kind of distill these values about not judging people for their skin color and not being prejudiced to his kids, who, of course, like they kind of seen as the outliers in the town, because, like, you know, this is a town in the South, so they're kind of seen as the outsiders. But yet Atticus Finch always stands up for his morals in doing the right thing. And his kids, at first they're like, oh, you know, they're just annoyed by their dad. But as the story progresses and where the trial goes, the kids start to kind of see the things that their father is doing and the things that he's trying to do what's right. And it is an amazing book. And it's like, yeah, I mean, it's one that everyone at some point would have had to have read, whether it's on their own or in high school. But it's just, and there's a good reason for that, because it's an amazing fucking book and that everyone should read, especially now in this day and age, which is probably even more relevant now than it did when it came out. And of course, being that it is also semi-based on things that also happened in Harper Lee's life as well, like, because I feel, from what I remember, it has been a little while since I've read the book or even seen the movie that it's based on as well, which is also an amazing film. It was set in the 1930s, from what I remember. So, like, even now, almost 90 years later, there's a lot of things that have not changed since the events of that story. But it's just a great book that really dives into racism and how it affects a small town. And, like, you, even though all this is happening, you can still be a good person who wants and set out to do the right thing. And it's, yeah, I mean, what more can I say about To Kill a Mockingbird? It's just an amazing book.
Look, if you're going to, I think it's one of the best books ever written. And it's really good to kind of pair it with something. Okay. So have you read In Cold Blood by Truman Capote?
Mm-hmm.
I haven't read the book. I've seen
you
the movie.
Absolutely.
But I know, like, I've also seen both Truman Capote adaptations about him writing that book. And I know that he and Harper Lee were not only best friends, but were childhood best friends. So I think, yeah, you're right. It'd be an interesting thing kind of reading both those books, even though I haven't read In Cold Blood myself, but I know it's probably that book is one of the most famous nonfiction books. So it'd be an interesting kind of reading both those ones, because until, you know, Harper Lee's, the only other book she wrote, Go Set a Watchman, I think is what it's called. The most controversial one, because I don't think she really wanted that book released, but it ended up being released anyway. Like, for the longest time, like, To Kill a Mockingbird was her first and only book. There's no other reason. I mean, yes, Go Set a Watchman came out, but that's, if you only ever had to write one book in your life, and it was as amazing as To Kill a Mockingbird, I can understand somebody like, you know what, I don't need to write anything else. Or maybe she wrote other things that, you know, that just would never be on the same kind of level as that one.
If you enjoyed To Kill a Mockingbird, a random recommendation to throw at you is a book called The Bottoms by Joe R. Lansdale. And it has a particular vibe and some of the content, but with a very, very slight on the edge kind of supernatural element. I think it's as good as To Kill a Mockingbird. And I think it's Joe Lansdale's best thing. And if you or anyone listening loves To Kill a Mockingbird, I think you really need to check out that particular book by Joe R. Lansdale. Go Set a Watchman is a bit of a sad story. You know, like, it's quite obvious that she didn't want that published. there are, I'm so glad I read it, because like any opportunity just to get back into that world, even though it's kind of like an alternate reality, is so special and rare. But just because it's rare and special doesn't mean that we should assault the elderly. And I think that that's maybe what Ghost Out of Watchmen actually is. It's the non-consensual subtraction of somebody's intellectual property when they're in a state of incapacitation. It's a pretty, and I might be reading into that too much, or I might be getting my facts wrong. I'm happy to be corrected, but it makes me feel a bit funny, must say. Sad. Anyway, the rest of this podcast has been really great and upbeating. Hannibal, anyone? Hannibal?
Well, I think we had a great discussion. Longer than I expected, because I didn't expect this podcast to go as long as it did. But
yeah,
we're
probably going to have to jump off very soon.
Indeed. But
unfortunately, guys.
Yeah, but we had a great time talking about all these books as well. So I guess that could be a wrap for this episode of the show. Thank you, Marcy, for always being an awesome co-host as per usual.
You're welcome.
And also, Aaron, thank you for coming on and talking about the books that have changed our lives with us.
I'm so happy to have spent this time. I had no idea that 14 years had passed since we began this thing. And congratulations on almost your 30th anniversary on air. It's amazing. But just remember, our bodies are rotting. The Langoliers are coming for us. And if we don't get off the air soon, we're going to get eaten alive. Okay, we have to go.
Indeed. But before we finish up the episode, Marcy, where can people find us on the internet this week?
Yes, for all things for this podcast and all our other podcasts, head to supermarcy.com. It is our website and base of operations. You can find the Super Network on all your main socials, and you can find all the links to everything on the link tree, which is linktr.ee/thesupernetwork. And if you want to find me on the socials, I'm generally there under Super Marcy, and I'm sure you'll find me, and come say hello.
And Aaron, where can people find you on the internet this week? But also, where can people find and buy all your books?
Look, hit up wherever good books are sold. I would love for you to check out my stuff. Love it or hate it, leave a review anywhere you can. If you like it, spread the word. I'm an indie author, and word of mouth means a lot. And if you're passionate about it, even if you hate it, scream it. You can hit me up on Twitter. I'm at Aaron Dries. I'm on TikTok at @AaronDries_writer. I'm on Instagram. You can check out aarondries.com, which is my website. Or alternatively, just scream into the void and then some cosmic, entity will give me a nudge and I'll scream back.
<It'll be fine. laughs> And for me personally, you can find me on my Twitter page at twitter.com/BeedJermaine or my Letterboxd account at letterboxd.com/BeedJermaine. You can find all my work over at supermarcy.com with all my reviews and columns. And of course, all the shows that I co-host with Super Marcy. And also you can find my solo podcast, Bead versus the Living Dead, on all podcast streaming services everywhere. And you can also follow me, the official Twitter account of that one, at twitter.com/BeedVSTLD. So yes, that is a wrap of this episode of the Super Podcast. Thank you for all of our listeners for joining in, and we'll see you all next time. See you, everybody. Bye-bye.
Super Network is proudly sponsored by Surfshark VPN.
Why would you have a VPN in this day and age? Well, a lot of people are quite concerned about tracking and their online privacy, and using a VPN ensures that you are safe and secure online. Surfshark VPN provides a lot of extra added layers of security, as well as ad blocker and a kill switch if your information is ever compromised.
A great bonus feature with having Surfshark is something is not available on your streaming service in your country. You just pop on that Surfshark VPN and you can probably find so much more streaming in different countries. If you want to find something like Masters of Horror, it is available on Tubi. So just select the correct country and you'll be able to watch such a great and fantastic show.
Surfshark VPN is one of the most reliable and cheapest of the VPNs out there, with up to 81% off offer when you subscribe for 24 months. Please use the link surfshark.deals/supernetwork to take advantage of this amazing deal.
You can also find the link in the show notes.
Thank you, Surfshark. Surfy shark do 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 do. Surfy shark do 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 do.
And now back to the show.